Thanks for downloading the Overdrive podcast. If you're ever looking to get behind the scenes, it's simple. Follow us on Instagram at TSN1050, or you will see myself, O-Dog and Noodles, what we do in the studio, before the show, during the show, after the show, constantly updating stories and best of clips. Again, follow us on Instagram at TSN1050.
This is Overdrive on TSN 1050.
Brian Hayes and Dave Festchuk from The Star in here. Just heard Fergie give an update of the Jays game. Marcus Stroman getting rocked. He's got a 5.29 ERA, and that looks like it's going to move on up. There really is just nothing appealing about this team. It's very difficult to get invested in. You know that there's going to be turnover. You know that they'd still like to move more guys. They want Donaldson to return to form or some sort of form so they can trade him before the end of the month. Granderson, if there was a taker, they'd flip him in a heartbeat. Same thing with a couple of guys out of the bullpen, you would assume. And really, what we're bracing ourselves for is an offseason chock full of, will they trade Marcus Stroman? Will they trade Aaron Sanchez? Who else is going to go out the door?
And what can they get for Josh Donaldson, if anything?
I'm not convinced that's going to happen. Like, I'm really not. He's got to play, because they could trade him. We established that yesterday. They could flip him to a team, but they're not going to get anything in return. The guy's on the DL.
I know.
And he's been on the DL all year. He's had an injury-riddled season for two years now, basically.
But all the insiders keep saying there's faint hope that if he can get back and play a few games and not look like a train wreck, he's still an asset that they can move. I mean, I'm as skeptical as you are. But there does seem to be at least a push on behalf of Shapiro and Atkins to at least float the idea that this could possibly be an outcome that would favor the Blue Jays instead of the disaster that it appears it could be, which is have an MVP caliber talent heading into a new era and not get anything for him to pipe, you know, to improve the pipeline of prospects that you're trying to put around the Vladdy Guerrero Juniors of the world.
Well, it's in his best interest to get on the field and get flipped and go play somewhere where the spotlight is on.
Yeah.
Because Donaldson wants to get paid.
Exactly.
And if he does not play, or if he returns in September and looks okay, he's not going to get anything in the offseason.
No.
He'll be 33 years old. They'll be coming off a couple of injury-riddled seasons. Guys over 30 don't get paid that much anyway. Last offseason in baseball was really a monumental moment where teams almost colluded with one another and said, let's all band together and not pay these guys anything.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there were a lot of old guys who were waiting to get paid that could still play that never got deals.
No, exactly. And that's the scary thing. When you think about what Josh Donaldson stood to earn back in 2016 when he's the MVP, and what he's going to earn in 2019 when he's, as you say, an unrestricted free agent. I mean, the game just turned. The tide turned. The analytics crowd got wind of data that suggested the fall off of older players is a lot larger than anybody probably assumed. Just looking at it in plain sight, if you really look at the numbers hard, the fall off is massive into the 30s in terms of, and we saw with Jose Bautista, you know, just hitting bat speed can fall off so quickly. You can go from being a really good player to being a nothing guy in a blink of an eye.
And your defense is going to drop off.
Yeah.
Now, that's not why you get paid. You get paid for your bat, but Donaldson was a legitimate third base talent. I mean, he was a guy who could play third base. Bautista in his prime was a quality right fielder.
With a great arm. Once his arm went,
exactly.
It changed everything.
It changed everything. So,
and you got to be able to stay healthy, and Josh Donaldson just can't prove that he can.
No. So, you know, it'll be intriguing to see how quickly he tries to get back, how quickly he pushes it because of how desperate he is. And it behooves the Jays to get him back on the field ASAP. I mean, if he could play this afternoon, you throw him on the field. I don't care if you got to get him out there on a stretcher, you get him out there just to prove that he can play. You got to get him off the DL.
Without a doubt.
And then just pray that there's a team that takes a run at him. Not even for what he would be doing in this current moment, but the idea that he comes alive in September. Because he'd be clearly going to a contender, obviously.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, you have to.
Seven or eight teams in the league that would kick tires on him.
For sure.
And
it'll be intriguing, man. The interesting thing to me is, the one thing I'm really intrigued is, you know, we had Richard Griffin on yesterday, and he really strongly feels that the Blue Jays will bring up Vladdy Guerrero Jr. in September. You know, there'll be, what, 16 home games in September. They could probably fill the dome in a way they haven't been able to do that very often this season. But I'm wondering, the more I think about that, it's not just about the service time, because we all know the service time concerns about if he exceeds 172 days next year, then his free agency comes a year earlier. And obviously, those whatever days he played, you know, this year would be tacked on to that total, and would and you'd maybe be sacrificing a full year of his service because of it. But I'm just worried. I'm worried about him being around this bad news Bears kind of team.
That's yeah, that's just, a whole new another layer to it that we weren't really expecting or really talking about.
Yeah.
Was the idea that he'd be walking into a clubhouse that knows their season is over, that could be somewhat toxic, you know, because you can spin it both ways. You get taste of the big league life, what it's like to be in that clubhouse, what it's like to be on the planes and the five-star treatment and yeah. the media and just getting a feel for the Rogers Center and the city. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can benefit from that. But, you know, if you're showing up and your manager's on his last leg, there are players here that are clearly aware that they have no future with the team, and who knows what their attitude is going to be like. And then you tack on the service time. I'm not convinced he's coming up.
No, neither am I.
I'm not convinced at all. But I think Griff's point was it's tied to day one of next season.
Yes.
Because if he's breaking camp with them next season, you might as well bring him up now if you feel mm-hmm. like he's ready for it and you can get past maybe some of the clubhouse issues or the general attitude of the ball club, because the clock is going to be starting early next year anyway if he breaks camp with them.
Or you do what the Cubs did with Chris Bryant, where you wait 12 days. It's a matter of 12 days.
Right.
It's a huge technicality where if you don't break camp with him, you leave him in the minors for 12 days, all of a sudden you get an extra year out of the guy. And so for Vladdy Guerrero Jr., it would be he's a free agent in 2024. If you don't wait those 12 days, he's a free agent in 2025 if you do.
Yes, and listen, if he's a superstar like we expect that he will be, that last year of control is not going to factor in. They're not going to keep taking him to arbitration and stuff. At some point, they're going to have to act like a big league club and pay the kid.
But it puts everything off a year.
It potentially does.
Yeah.
Unless 4 or 5 years into his career, they give him, you know, a 7-year deal worth $25 million a year because he's proven he's an MVP caliber guy.
Right.
And then it ends up being somewhat irrelevant. I would say that as much as I'm impatient and I want to see him, you know, I'm really curious to see him in the majors, and September would be a fun ride to watch him, and I'd go down to the park to see him without question. I tend to agree with you. I don't think it makes the most sense, because even next year, if you hold him back 12 days or 2-3 weeks, whatever it is, come next April, there's a very good chance the Leafs and the Raptors are going to be in the playoffs.
Yeah.
No one's going to be paying attention to the Blue Jays anyway. And that team ain't going to be any good next year anyway either. They're not.
No.
There's nothing that's going to happen between now and the beginning of next season that is going to lead to anybody in Toronto thinking the Jays are going to win 90-plus games.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine. The Yankees and the Red Sox will own the division again next year. That should be the expectation. That more than likely will be the expectation. So waiting an extra 2 or 3 weeks from breaking camp next year for a season that is more than likely going to be lost, and they're admitting to it this year that they're starting to look towards the future. I don't think Shapiro and Atkins are going to sell us on this idea that they're going to be competitive next year the same way that they did last offseason.
No.
They're not going to come out and say we're going to be awful or pain is coming or anything like that, but I don't think they're going to be as cavalier with
it'll be interesting to see how they frame it.
Expectations.
It'll be interesting to see how they frame it, because they totally botched this year, right? They totally misread the market. This whole nod to the fans, we're doing this for the fans, we're taking one last run with Josh Donaldson for the fans, because the fans show up. I mean, that to me was the most, you know, kind of novice read of this market. Like, this is a sophisticated sports market. People understand what rebuilds are. They just saw the Leafs go through it. They sat through it. They were patient with it. They didn't complain about it. If Shapiro and Atkins would have just outlined their Chicago Cubs-esque tank nation plan and said, look, we're sinking it to the bottom. We're trading Donaldson. We're trading everybody because we got this young prospect pool that we want to expand on. You know what? The Cubs did it in 5 years. Theo Epstein had a World Series championship. The Houston Astros sat through 100-plus lost seasons. They're the reigning World Series championships. We think it's the blueprint. We think it's the model. Nobody would have batted an eye.
No, and it would have started with Donaldson.
Yeah.
If you flipped him at the winter meetings, all of a sudden that sends a totally different message to all of your fans. And in reality, even they haven't had Donaldson all year anyway. Now,
that's
they couldn't
I mean.
Predict that.
They couldn't predict
but
it. But
with or without him, they're still not, they're going to win 70 games.
Yeah.
So you may as well have a totally different impression of where they are at and where they're going. And they've got a good farm system. Like, they've got the number one prospect in baseball. And Bo Bichette's going to be a player by all accounts. And yeah. there are other guys who don't have the
same. Jansen, the catcher, the Biggio kid looks decent.
Absolutely. And they've got a couple of arms down there that Atkins points out from time to time that they're pretty high on. So, you know, if you brought in that Donaldson Hall last winter, you make the other moves that you've made leading up to the trade deadline this year, you're still going to end up with the same record that you have right now anyway, but you're probably that much further ahead, and you get people to focus on the fact that you're more than likely have a top five farm system in baseball.
Yeah.
And
instead, what they did, they raised ticket prices. They sell people on the idea they can be competitive, even though a lot of people, you and I included, were like, no. They
not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Everybody was saying it before the season, not during the season. Before the season, there were a lot of people saying this team was not going to be competitive in an AL East with the Yankees and the Red Sox rising again as the monsters they are. It just wasn't going to happen.
Right.
Even if everybody had career years, it would have been a stretch.
And even that, again, is important to point out. With or without Donaldson this year, with or without whatever they were paying lip service to, the Yankees and the Sox are more than likely going to dominate here for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a lot of heavy lifting to do. And that's what's so disappointing about this Donaldson and the misread in terms of what they should have done with him, because you needed to capitalize on that, because you need to start hitting grand slams.
Yeah.
You need talent.
That's the thing.
You need superstar talent. Like, look at the Yankees 1-9. Look at the Sox. Sox are going to win 113 games or something this year.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to have one of the great seasons in the history of Major League Baseball.
It's insane.
And they're loaded with young talent.
Homegrown talent.
Homegrown that they have control
over. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that's the thing.
Model.
Like, it's
that's
not just
model.
Vladdy. They need a lot more than that.
That's the thing. You need to, if it's just Vladdy, I mean, you're dooming Vladdy to a miserable career.
Right.
You know, like, if you don't put the resources and you don't stockpile the cupboard around this kid, I mean, what are you introducing him to? You're introducing him into a toxic situation where, you know, underperformance is going to be the norm. And we've seen that movie before with the Blue Jays. Like, we've seen really good players come to this team in that 22-year window where they didn't make the playoffs. And it was just, you know, it was just a bad swing and a miss for these careers, and you hate to see it. You hate to, like, Roy Halladay, for instance, never had enough around him.
He's on an island a lot.
You know, was a star player that needed to get out of town to have a chance at winning. Carlos Delgado, you know, you can go through the list of guys that played in this town and never had enough around them, and you don't want to see Vladdy Guerrero Jr. join that list.
David Purnum, writer for ESPN, on the gambling connection with the NBA and MGM. We'll get to that in about 15 minutes, but it is a Wednesday. We haven't had Jerry's percentages in quite some time, and Jerry's on vacation. He's off for a couple of months, but he's nice enough because we're into August now. And he's trying to gear up. He's back in the gym, and he understands that he's going to be back on full-time come September. Emailed a few percentages our way.
Wow.
So we figured, let's knock the dust off Jerry in the intro and play it, and we'll get to a couple of Jerry's percentages on a Wednesday in August.
You're going to want to hear this.
Jerry's percentages.
I'm a cowboy, baby. With the top let down and the sunshine shining.
No, keep the booing.
Are we having fun yet?
You're all pigeons. Filthy, filthy pigeons.
Are you kidding? Have you been out drinking?
It's Jerry. G-E-R-R-Y.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. And he emailed a couple of baseball takes, but I'm done with it. We'll get to that later in the afternoon. We're not talking baseball anymore. These are courtesy of Jerry, emailed. Okay. You know how this game works, Dave.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorites.
One of the great games in the history of sports radio.
There's no doubt.
Yes. Very prestigious takes. And he throws them out. A lot of them are very hot, scorching takes, and we place a percentage on the likelihood of them actually happening. So the first one, courtesy of Geraldo, was all three of Mitch Marner, Austin Matthews, and William Nylander will be signed before camp starts. All three will be signed to either bridge deals, long-term deals, one-year deals, but all three of them will sign contracts with the Maple Leafs before camp starts. That's a take from Jerry.
That's a good one. Jerry is on vacation, but he brings some pretty big heat in this moment. I love it. Well, let me start. I'm going to say that my Jerry's percentage on that possibility would be 60%.
60%.
I'm optimistic that could be the reality we're living in come the start of training camp.
Really? Yeah, see, I'm not that high.
No.
I'm not that high. I think it's important that he says before camp starts.
Yeah.
I could see Nylander dipping in a day or two into camp. I could see that being a possibility. I'm bracing myself for Matthews signing long term. The Marner angle is why I become more pessimistic with this take. I just don't know how either camp feels about their leverage, what either camp would feel is ideal at this moment. I think the Leafs would love to lock him up long term at a, you know, they pay him a respectable number, but if they could get him at like a 6-year deal at $6 million, I think they'd take that in a heartbeat. They'd be stupid not to.
But would he take that?
That's the point. I think it's more likely that Marner says, okay, I'll take another year playing with Tavares, and I'm going to put up 85 points.
Well, that's the risk.
That's the risk. But he has the right to say, we'll hold off. Now, in a year, even if he puts up those numbers, it doesn't mean the Leafs have to capitulate and give him an 8-year deal at $10 million per. He'll still be an RFA without any arb rights, and they'll still have a lot of power based on the CBA and based on the way the league works, because no one hands out offer sheets in the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
So they're still going to have some leverage, make no mistake. But I think it's the Marner camp and just his scenario and how unique it is because of the numbers he's put up, because of the position he plays, more likely he doesn't end up getting signed. I think it's a possibility, but I'll say 25%.
Okay.
25% that all three of them are signed before day one of camp. So that's the first one from Jerry. The second one. The Raptors will make at least one more trade before the beginning of the NBA season. You want me to go first on this one?
You know what? I like this one. They're not done. I will say, I'm high on this. I'm going to say, will it be a trade or will it just be a free agent signing? That'll be the question.
Well, I guess a transaction. Maybe I misread the email.
I would say if it's a transaction, I'm going to say 90%. I think they've definitely got a spot to fill. We've heard they're looking at Greg Monroe as a big man possibility to fill the spot they have. Whether they go that direction, whether they do make a trade. Hey, it's not out of the realm of possibility they could make a trade. Masai Ujiri's obviously, you know, feels he's close. I mean, you look at this team, you're like, this team has a chance to get to the finals. You better make sure you got the proper complementary pieces in place to maximize its ability to move forward in a playoff series. So, but I think transaction, yeah, I'm high on that. 90%.
90%. Yeah, I'm pretty high on transaction too. I'll go 91% to pass you in terms of transaction. In terms of trade, I'm closer to 50%. I think, you know, we know that Masai would love to trade Norman Powell, I think.
Well, who wouldn't?
Although he was committed to Norman Powell a year ago. Like, he gave him the deal with the money. And maybe he blames Dwayne Casey for not finding the minutes or not massaging him into the lineup or the rotation a little bit more. Although I think it's on Norman Powell. He looked awful. There's
looked
a reason
terrible.
He didn't play. But
yeah,
I think
but you're right. Four years, $40 million
left on that.
Starting next, it starts next season. It's an extension that starts next season.
Right.
So yeah, they'd love to trade Norman Powell, but
Serge Ibaka, they would if it made sense. I would think
not happening.
But do you think Masai really wants to trade Serge? Or do you think, because that's another guy he just signed last year? He didn't have to.
Yeah,
he gave the money to Norman Powell. Didn't work out for him. He gave the extension and the money to Ibaka. Didn't work out for him.
Well,
but it was a guy. These are two guys a year ago that he was committed to.
Well, we spent a few minutes, Josh Lundberg and I, talking with Nick Nurse down in Vegas, the new Raptors head coach. And he'd just come back from meeting with Serge Ibaka and said, you know, as most coaches will say in the offseason, guy looks great. He's, you know, he's lean. He looks hungry. But he better, because he's got 2 years pending on that deal, $21 million. Nearly $22 million kicking in this year, and then another year, $23 million. So, man, it's a deal you would love to move, but given Serge's performance in the playoffs last year, it's just not a possibility.
He has
to redeem himself to make that expiring contract at the end of next season. That could be movable if this guy, you know, shows he can actually play again.
Mm-hmm.
But right. Yeah,
we're both pretty low on the idea of a trade then, right?
It's going to be hard to trade any of these guys.
The NBA shuts down this time of year too. Like everyone's kind of made their moves.
You would think,
unless you know you feel like you're fleecing somebody, but in reality, that's probably not going to present itself.
But you said the name. I mean, Norm Powell is the guy.
That's the guy.
And
I could see teams looking at him. Like, he's still got the talent. You know, he showed spurts in his first couple of years of being a guy that could potentially be not necessarily an impact player. I never saw him as like a burgeoning star ever. And I argued with different people. I never saw him as a guy who's going to be like the third piece behind Kyle and DeMar.
Well, the main problem with him is, look, it's a league that just, you know, absolutely is obsessed with length now, you know, wingspan, height. This is a guy who's listed at 6'4". He might be 6'2", 6'3". And it's like Mike Babcock always says, you know, he's 6'3" all day. He's 6'3" every day.
And if you can't shoot the lights out, and
you have to have that, you know, no one's Steph Curry, but you got to be in the Steph Curry mold of being able to have unlimited range and be a threat at all times, because he's not a threat going at defenders that are 6'10", and that's what you're facing now in an Eastern Conference with Ben Simmons playing point guard at 6'10", long as heck and quicker than you, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a tough reality for Norm Powell. Let's hope he's working on his shooting.
This is the next one here is a Johnny Football take from Jerry.
And love
it's
it.
Somewhat subjective. I mean, he's being somewhat vague with his take, but Jerry is calling it that Friday night when the Alouettes play host to the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Johnny Football will be the starting QB for Montreal, that Manziel will have a successful first start this Friday. So that's a bit of a vague you know, what exactly does that constitute? What is a successful start? I think Jerry's saying he's not going to get laughed off the field. He's not going to get crushed. He's not going to throw, you know, 5 picks in 14 attempts like Jay Peterman did for the Bills last year. He's saying Manziel's going to look pretty good, look pretty comfortable, and you're going to walk away from this thinking, okay, this guy's got a future here in the CFL.
You know what? Having watched that game in the preseason that was on TSN and Manziel got some playing time, I was impressed by that. I was wishing he would have played out of the gate in Hamilton, and I wish he would have usurped Mazzoli in Hamilton before they traded him. So I'm sort of high on this happening. I know for a positive outcome, given the Alouettes are 1-5, it's been a dismal season. You know, anything decent will be taken as a positive, right? Anything not a disaster. So I'm going to go 78% that it's going to be a positive night for Johnny Manziel and the Alouettes.
Right. I mean, relatively speaking, you're right. If this guy even looks like a competent football player, it's a successful night for Montreal because they've just been awful for 2 years. He's come out and said he feels comfortable. He said he's not feeling nervous. I don't believe that for a second. I understand why he's trying to put forth that front, but I think it's actually in his best interest to say, yeah, I am a little nervous. I haven't played in over 2 years,
yeah,
and I'm looking forward to it, but there's going to be some nerves. You don't have to play, you know, Johnny Cool Guy all the time. You're human.
Yeah.
This is a big moment for you. You want to get back to the NFL. It starts here. It's going to be a long journey. He also said that he's feeling more comfortable because he's going up against the defense that he knows.
Yeah.
Because he practiced with Hamilton, which I don't dispute. But that defense also knows Johnny Football. And he hasn't started a game in over 2 years. And the offensive line in Montreal is just abysmal.
That's an issue.
I am pessimistic. I'm looking forward to seeing him play. I think he's got a shot at being a successful CFL quarterback. I don't expect him to have a fun night on Friday night. Now, Hamilton is not a great team. No team is great in the East, but he's only been there for a week and a half. He doesn't have a great grasp of the playbook. It's not possible for him to have cohesion with the offense because he just hasn't been there long enough. He's had 4 or 5 days of first-team reps, and he hasn't played in over 2 years. And maybe he's awful. Like, who knows? And I mean that, like, in general. Maybe he can't play anymore.
Yeah.
Obviously, we saw what he did with the Browns. Like, him winning the Heisman, that's a long time ago, man.
Yeah.
So I'm pessimistic. I'm going to say 30%. He has a successful opener.
See, I mean, I saw enough in that one preseason game that I happened to watch.
Up against second and third defenses, yeah, though, at that point.
It's second and third defense, but he made plays with his legs that impressed me, that speak to a guy who's going to have a poor offensive line that's going to be leaky as all get out, and he's going to have to get out of the pocket and move and throw on the move. And you know what? I think he did that in the one game we've seen, the one little bit of sample size we've seen. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think, you know, the one thing, the red flag is, you know, Naylor was on, you know, Landsberg in the morning earlier this week and talked about how maybe he wasn't a model backup, maybe he wasn't, you know, sort of doing the things that a coach would want to see a backup do in Hamilton. Maybe he wasn't as studious as you hope, and you worry that maybe he's not serious. Maybe he is still the guy that got run out of the NFL for not being serious about being a professional.
Right.
You worry about that, even though all the talk about him, you know, turning his life around and finding, you know, various ways to cope with his demons. But man, the bottom line is, people are talking about the CFL on ESPN in the States. Yeah. People are talking about it on Pro Football Talk. I mean,
in Toronto, people are talking about it.
We're talking about it.
Yes.
And that's why if you're Randy Ambrosi, if you're the CFL in general, you're crossing your fingers.
This is what you envision. Oh, you're praying that he turns into a stud, you know, or at least becomes an intriguing member of the CFL.
Yeah.
You know, and a guy that people can have takes on. That's what they need. You need players that people can debate. Yeah. That's the world we live in now. It's the talking head world.
And that's why my bar for success in his first start's really low. All to me that he has to do to prove he's successful is show some glimpses. He can also have some brutal series where he just gets crushed. He can't move. He can't make the throw. That's fine. But if he also has two or three plays where he comes out of the pocket, makes a play on the move that makes you go, well, there's a possibility.
Now, there's the guy who won the Heisman. That's the guy to remember.
That's the guy. And as long as that happens, then I think there's hope that he can actually make it in this league, because we've seen a million guys that can't, that come from the States, highly touted, Heisman Trophy winners or not, that just can't do it. But if he can do that, you know, here and there, it'll be a great sign.
Tiger Woods in the field this weekend at the Bridgestone. First time in a long time. He's playing the week before a major. It's the PGA Championship next week. And the final, Jerry, revolves around the hectic schedule of Tiger Woods, because he is now qualified, obviously. He's playing in the FedEx, and the first three legs of the FedEx playoff go back to back to back.
Yeah.
And if he ends up in the top 30 in terms of points, which if he plays in it, there's a real chance he'll play in the Tour Championship, which would lead to him playing in six events over the next 53 days.
Mm-hmm.
He has not done this in years. The final, Jerry, is that Tiger will play in six events over the next 53 days, and his body will hold up. He will not withdraw. He will look good. Jerry's a confident man that Tiger Woods will play a lot of golf down the stretch, and he'll perform pretty well. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm like any person that cares about the game of golf. I hope that's the case, because the golf world's a heck of a lot more fun when Tiger Woods is a big part of it. But I'm, you know, having spoken to people, you know, when he had the spinal fusion surgery, I reached out to a bunch of people who were experts in that field, and there was a real concern that when you have that surgery, yeah, you fuse the two discs that are problematic, but then you get a problematic point around the fusion eventually with wear and tear. And, you know, with a guy into his 40s, playing this amount of golf in this short a time span, I'm really, you know, if I'm, you know, his agency, if I'm worried about Tiger Woods' well-being, I'm crossing my fingers, because, man, this is where it'll be tested. This is where how strong is that back? We're about to find out in these 6 weeks to come.
And he wants to play in the Ryder Cup, which goes right after the Tour Championship in Paris.
Exactly.
So you could be looking at, I guess, really seven events technically over the course of
eight weeks, give or take.
But this is what he's got to do. This comes at the perfect time for Tiger Woods. We've been through the back injuries. We've been through the lower body injuries. We've been through the my glutes aren't shooting.
Yeah,
you know, timeline of his career.
The DUI, the rehab stuff.
It's time to start playing, man. And it's time to really get out there and not only gear up for the Masters or the Open Championship. PGA next week, obviously the fourth major, big tournament. This week he's playing at the Bridgestone, big tournament with a big field. The FedEx, they need him.
Badly.
They need him, too, because this has been somewhat of a bust for non-diehards, because it's been confusing to follow the way the FedEx really works,
the
point system. And I don't know if there's been as much pull towards it, because Tiger hasn't really been involved since its inception.
Well, he's a lock to make the playoffs, which is great.
Exactly, being in the top 50 now. So I'm pretty high on this. I think he understands that he's got to prove it at some point. He's got to get out there and play. And I think once he finds a rhythm, he's going to play pretty well. Because he's looked good at times this year. He's looked very good.
And this is like, this will be fun beginning tomorrow at Firestone, because he's owned that course.
Exactly. I mean, he crushes this course.
He hasn't played there since 2014, mind you. But he's playing a practice round today out there with Phil Mickelson, apparently.
Well, they're boys now.
Yeah, they're buddies. It's hilarious that they were the arch enemies of the golf world, and now they're out there playing a money game on a Wednesday. Isn't it hilarious?
I'm at 75%.
So you're going 75.
Yeah.
You know,
I love Tiger. I want to believe it.
I'm going to go more. I'm going to go optimistic too because I want to believe it too. So I'll go 78. I would love to see it. And man, we need it. Like the game needs it.
Yes.
The sports world needs it.
Right.
It'd be so much fun. It just adds such a great layer. And you talk about, yeah, one more major. You got the Ryder Cup against a great European team. It's going to be hard to beat on European soil. So, man, wouldn't it be great if Tiger was integral to that race?
Well, last time, again, we saw him was at the Open, and he's sitting on the 11th tee with a solo lead of a major.
I mean, again,
you know, like
the biggest buzz around golf in a decade, right?
I mean, biggest number since he won in 06,
yeah,
I think it was.
Yeah,
and really, the only time it's been beaten this century was in 2000 at St. Andrews when Tiger Woods won.
Yeah.
Like, that's just what he brings. He brings buzz, he brings viewers, he brings conversation and debate. Like,
and
you just said about Johnny Manziel, this is what you need.
And I don't know about your household, but I can get, like, I can convince my wife to get involved. We were at a family thing with my sister-in-law and brother-in-law who don't care about sports. Suddenly, Tiger's involved. They care.
Same thing. Yeah. A couple of weeks ago during the Open, like, we had been at a, I think we were at a wedding the night before. I can't remember our schedule now. It's all confusing. I think we were at a wedding the night before. And, yeah, we were. We came home, and we were kind of easing into the day a little bit, and our daughter was up. And then all of a sudden, I check out Twitter, and it's like Tiger's roaring here. And it was, got to throw on Tiger.
Yeah.
Sorry, Disney Jr., you got to go. You got to go.
But you just engage. You can engage the whole world. People just care about this guy.
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
David Purdom, writer for ESPN The Chalk, which is a gambling element of ESPN.com, will join us about the significance of yesterday's news where the NBA and MGM are getting into bed with each other for the future of gaming in pro sports. So we'll catch up with David, and what kind of cash do you think the NHL could potentially get here? How many casinos and resorts are dying to get into bed with the NHL? We'll see. That's coming up. Overdrive continues on the TSN app. Steve Phillips will join us in about a half an hour. You just heard Fergie, Marcus Stroman. Rough afternoon in Oakland. Gets through five innings, 11 hits, 7 earned. His ERA's up to 5.63. That's tough, man. It's tough.
He is struggling big time, isn't
he? Yeah, this is pretty much the worst possible season he could have. Outside of an injury. But even an injury would keep the hope of maybe what he could be going forward. You know, in terms of whatever his value is and how they... Because even that, you keep hearing the Jays... And I understand it. You got leverage. He's under control. He does have talent. He's put up good years. Last year, he had 200 innings and like a 3 ERA. So, you know, if you ever think of trading him, you got to get the most possible you can. But the idea that this guy's going to bring in a haul that would be equivalent to, you know, a top 10 or 12 pitcher in the game is just... Absolutely not reality.
Oh, it's not. It's not reality at all. I mean, and this is... As you said, this is getting ugly for him. I mean, you're looking at career worst ERA, career worst WHIP. I mean, career worst opposing batting average. I mean, it's getting worse. It's a death spiral for the kid, and he's not a kid anymore.
He's 27 years old. Yeah,
and you know the chip on his shoulder gets bigger as his numbers get bigger with it.
So, Steve Phillips in about a half an hour. Let's catch up with David Purdom, writer for ESPN Chalk, about the big news yesterday: the NBA and MGM. Getting in bed together in terms of the future of gaming and their connection and the significance of this. And here he is back on the show again. Here's David Purdom. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
We're doing all right. You know, this wasn't a surprise, the news yesterday, because Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, has been pretty open about this for a while, that, you know, they think sports gambling's happening anyway. They might as well try to take advantage of it. And when it became legalized in the United States, this was a domino that we expected to fall. Were you surprised that it happened so quickly, though, that MGM and the NBA would work to a deal this quickly, like they announced yesterday?
I wasn't not really surprised, just because by going first, you get your pick of the company you want to partner with. And MGM and NBA have a relationship. A WNBA franchise started there in Las Vegas this year, the Aces. So there's a relationship there. As you mentioned, you know, Adam Silver's been very progressive on this. They had been trying to kind of work out some sort of deal in states where they would get paid a fee off based on the amount wagered on the NBA. They hadn't had much success on that. So a commercial deal was the next likely option, and that's what they went with.
So, David, I mean, what do you think this is heading toward? Obviously, this deal is the beginning of something. We've heard the NHL wants to get into bed with in a partnership such as this. The PGA Tour has talked about it, Major League Baseball. I mean, why are these organizations all rushing to get into partnerships with these businesses?
Revenue streams. They're just looking for more and more revenue streams, and gaming is the next one. Kind of the next runway that they're taking off of in terms of revenue. And, you know, I don't think anybody has a clear-cut, definitive idea or strategy on how they want to monetize legalized sports betting, but they're certainly looking at all avenues. And the one I know that they think they have value in is their data, their statistics that are coming out of the game. And if they can some sort of feed that is quicker in delivering and transmitting this data to sports books, that will help in the future when in-game wagering, which is something that's really big in the UK and is expected to take off in the US in the coming years, that data will become much more valuable then.
Well, David Purdom of ESPN, well, that's what we were talking a lot about yesterday, is in-game mm-hmm. betting is already starting to build up here. I wouldn't call it an explosion yet, but I think it's right around the corner. And we were talking about the limitations and the potential controversies that can come with it, because if, let's say in the NBA, you can bet on whether or not a guy's going to hit a field goal or not, it would be easy for that player to throw that field goal, right? To potentially open up the door for some sort of nefarious act to be taking place. I could picture a scenario where the NBA decides to take those type of in-game bets off the board. So if it's who's going to get a foul next, you take it off the board. If it's who's going to hit the field goal next, will they hit the field goal, you take it off the board. In other words, it's got to be something in the action that would involve both teams, you know, offensively, defensively, et cetera. Could you picture a scenario like that, at least early on, where they really try to limit the amount of in-game bets that you can make just to make it feel as if it's on the up and up?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that NBA and Major League Baseball have been lobbying in other states, trying to say, hey, give us some kind of input on what kind of wagers you're offering. Because if you're offering who's going to commit the first foul of the game, you know, that's easily able to be corrupt. However, the limits on those type of wagers in the regulated markets currently are pretty small. Maybe you get down a couple $100, maybe. It would just be the economics of it all really doesn't make sense. Because then when you put on top of the salaries of these players, you know, millions and millions of dollars, surely they're not going to risk that to help out their friend win a couple $100 on a bet. Now, referees, we had Tendane 10 years ago, 11 years ago. Maybe he works that some sort of, somebody like that would be an issue. So there are concerns, and I always like to say this, whether we legalize sports betting in the U.S. or not, there was going to be gambling scandals in the future. I think that legalizing it will help us just detect those better and compared to the ones that, you know, were placed with illegal operators and we didn't really have any, you know, transparency with them.
So, David, we know that the football obviously is the behemoth when it comes to sports betting. I was reading one of your columns from a while back. It talked about $17 billion bet on the NFL and college football combined in Nevada last year, I guess it was. Gary Bettman's talking about trying to get hockey involved bigger in sports betting, and probably with a partnership similar to what the NBA just signed. I mean, I guess you can probably, you know, measure their handle on hockey in the hundreds of millions. It's not about billions, but what kind of potential would hockey have if they try to venture into this realm? In your mind,
it's going to be tough. The Vegas Knights had a really successful season, obviously, and got a lot of attention, and that really took over that town in Vegas, and betting, and it surged on hockey up 10%. That will probably, you know, kind of wear down a little bit as the novelty wears off. And hockey, you know, it'll just kind of remain in that top tier of leagues here in the U.S., but probably at the bottom of those behind the NBA, behind Major League Baseball, and NFL. And one of the reasons why is because the way you bet on hockey is not as easy as a point spread in the NBA or NFL, and that's the same problem baseball runs into. You're looking at puck lines where you're playing odds, you know, minus 1.5 goals, plus 1.5 goals, or strict money lines. And it's just not as simple for the general public that just wants to make a bet quickly. They understand the point spread quickly. When we start getting into money lines and puck lines, it's a little more confusing, and that's always going to be a problem for hockey betting.
With David Burnham of ESPN. Again, yesterday the NBA and MGM come together, and the NBA, there are point spreads, so it's like football. It does open itself up to more generic bets, so to speak. But the NFL is obviously what Vegas would love to be connected to more than anything else. And the NFL may feel like they don't need to, but they're greedy too. You know, like you said at the top, this is about revenue streams. And if the NFL feels like at some point they can make money off this, and there's no question, I believe they could, what kind of bidding war do you think you'd have with casinos and with major resorts, et cetera, like we saw yesterday with the MGM? If the NFL put themselves out there and said, we're looking for a similar deal, would this just be a bloodbath or what? I mean, that's got to be what they'd all be seeking out, that kind of connection, that kind of relationship, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, absolutely. There would definitely be takers and interest in that. How much interest, how much money, is always up for debate. What yesterday's deal did with the NBA was it created a market for their product, for their data product, basically, and their logos. And that market didn't exist. Nobody was from the States were going to pay the NBA for that. So that basically started. So if you did that deal with an NFL, and there has been rumors that NFL teams have been contacting sportsbooks looking for sponsorship deals. But if you were able to do one deal with the NFL, then all those other sportsbooks, all those other gaming entities would have to look at it and say, is what they're giving the NFL, what the NFL is providing us, is that worth the cost? So a market has been created for this sports data. We're just trying to figure out how much it is actually worth.
Really appreciate the insight. Thank you for doing this, as always.
You got it, guys. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
There's David Purdom of ESPN, The Chalk. Yeah, the data, I mean, that's what Silver and the NBA were talking a lot about yesterday, but that's pretty heavy stuff. I mean, I don't know exactly what that means or what the benefit is in the end. I guess, well, MGM has a read on it.
That's the interesting thing. Like, the casinos have been offering these bets available on the NBA and the NFL and on down the line without paying the leagues anything.
Yeah, so how's this any different?
Well, the only thing that's different is now they're going to be able to use the logos and use the data and use the video stream, I guess. And I think what a lot of the speculation is, from my readings on it, is that eventually you'll be able to have your handheld device, watch the game, and bet on the game simultaneously as you watch the broadcast.
Right.
Like, there'll be a superimposed betting line on the screen for in-game betting, which, as David said, is very popular in Europe. It's very popular in the UK, and soccer is very popular in Asia, and cricket and things like that. And there's a lot of money to be made. And hey, these sports leagues are not stupid. They realize they look at the global scene, and they say, hey, they're making money where we could be making money. Let's go in that direction. And it's just a matter of time, right? There's only three states now. There's obviously Nevada's had sports betting all these years. Now, with the Supreme Court lifting the federal ban, you got Delaware, New Jersey, and Mississippi have already embraced it, and there's going to be more states to follow.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to become way more widespread, and I bet you'll see all kinds of different permutations and combinations on a state-to-state basis as it kind of gets rolled out.
And that's where MGM, if they've got the original partnership,
yeah,
they're going to be affiliated with it wherever it goes.
You want to be ahead of the game. It's small potatoes right now. It's like a $25 million deal, apparently, over a few years. So it's not like it's massive amounts of money changing hands, but it's a toe in the water to say, will this work? Will we be able to monetize this data? I guess the NBA's data is going to be a little better than the secondary data you can get. Because,
and who knows what that... Just being, let's say it's the NBA app sponsored by MGM.
Right.
That kind of advertisement,
right,
if it's in 30 different buildings around the NBA, that's worth a fortune.
It could be.
You know, that's what these casinos want. It's all about advertising.
Yeah.
You know, Vegas is the only city in the world that has a slogan. You know what I'm saying?
Like, oh, yeah.
And they, please come to Vegas. You know why they want you to come to Vegas? To spend money in Vegas.
100%.
And it's the same thing with any other, you know, massive business that gets into bed with any other company in terms of just a sponsorship fee.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what it sounds like to me. It's almost a sponsorship fee.
I think it is, in large, but it's also, I think, it's also the beginning of a relationship.
Yes, of course.
With plenty of room for growth, right? And I really think the whole future is in mobile betting, in in-game betting, and that's why they're getting together, because they just need, I think they feel they need the partnership with the league to have quality data and to be able to say, yes, mm-hmm. we have the data first. We're not going to have any data problems with, you know, who got that rebound and, you know, who, you know, what's going on? When did that free throw occur?
You don't want any corruption exactly. or shadiness or anything like that. And on the flip side, you can see where the NBA is like, we need a professional in the gambling world.
Right.
We need people that know what they're doing in this field.
Right.
And that's where MGM comes in.
And if you're worried about integrity issues, which they have to be, because as David pointed out, that, you know, we had Tim Donaghy not too long ago embroiled in a gambling scandal. Now they can monitor it, right? Like if you've got an eye on the betting lines and you understand who's betting and when, because you have all the information in front of you because you're partners with the gambling house that's taking the bets, you can feel good about the fact that, yeah, there's not anything funny going on here.
Steve Phillips just after 6 p.m. and we'll revisit the start of a new month and looking back on what was a very significant one in July, historic sports month here in Toronto with Tavares and Kawhi and Osuna. We'll get back into that in the 6 p.m. hour with Dave Feshchuk of the Star and Brian Hayes. Overdrive continues, TSN 1050. We should get into this Adam Jones stuff, too, down in Baltimore, where he's got 10-5 rights, and they wanted to trade him, and he just said, I'm not going anywhere. And I liked his explanation. He said, it's my life. I'll do whatever I want. I don't want to go anywhere. They asked me. I said no. Players in the union for years fought for these rights, and I'm going to take advantage. Now, people are spinning it like, well, why do you want to be on a losing club? Are you a loser now? And, I mean, it's kind of like the Matt Sundin scenario at the end of his reign here in Toronto, where
Very
people wanted
like
him to move on
yeah.
and reap the rewards of that type of a trade and start the rebuild, etc. But Matt said a no trade. He didn't have to go anywhere. And same thing with Adam Jones. He's been down in Baltimore for like 10 years, 11 years. He's like, I'm not going anywhere.
I loved his explanation.
I kind of like it.
It was great. No, he went on this incredible soliloquy about, hey, when players went on strike years ago, this is what they fought for the right to say, I don't want to move. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, I earned my place in this game. I earned my seniority. I earned my 10-5 rights. And there's a reason why we earned them. And we should exercise them. And anybody that wants to tell me that I should do this, I mean, they're not me. Why in this society does everybody think they have the right to say, well, you should do this and you should do that? And I'm with Adam Jones on this. Now, if I'm a fan of that team, I don't begrudge the fans of the team, just like I didn't begrudge Leaf fans for resenting the guy. It's their right to resent the guy and say, man, you'd really help us if you'd move along here and get us a haul of prospects so
yeah.
we could rebuild this thing. But if the guy doesn't want to do it...
He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do.
You respect that.
Yeah, exactly. He got traded early in his career from Seattle to Baltimore to begin with. He didn't want to do that, probably,
right.
but they traded him because
exactly.
he had no rights.
Exactly.
He's got rights. So we'll get into that more in the next hour. Steve Phillips on the recap of the trade deadline, what the Jays will do in August in terms of trades and waivers, etc. And Stroman got rocked this afternoon. What a shock.
Oh,
what a shock. Oakland about to sweep the Blue Jays, and then they're off to Seattle. Hour 3 up next. Overdrive continues on the TSN app.